All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're going to be doing a deep dive into a topic that I think is really, really fascinating. And, you know, it's kind of at this intersection, right, between traditional Hawaiian rights and how that all sort of interfaces with modern property law.
Absolutely.
For you law students out there, I think this is sort of the area where a lot of really interesting issues come up, right? Mm. You're dealing with a lot of legal theory, but also with a lot of really complicated real world issues. Yeah. And we're going to be unpacking that through a really interesting case.
Yeah.
Kalipi v. Hawaiian Trust Co. It's a 1982 case out of Hawaii.
It's a really important case for kind of understanding, you know, the broader question that often comes up in places like Hawaii. You know, we have these traditional gathering rights, but who can actually exercise them? Especially when it comes to, you know, private land, land that's owned in fee simple. And so that's really what Kalipi is all about. It's trying to figure out, you know, does residency, does living in a particular place matter when it comes to exercising these gathering rights?
Yeah. Yeah. And how do you balance that, right? How do you balance, you know, centuries of Hawaiian custom with this system that we've kind of superimposed on top of it, right? Which is the system that we largely have in place today in the United States and many other countries, which is, you know, this idea of fee simple ownership, which is essentially saying, you know, you have this bundle of rights as a property owner. And one of the key rights in that bundle is the right to exclude, right? The right to say who can and cannot be on your property. And Kalipi gives us a really interesting look at how the courts have tried to kind of navigate these really, really tricky waters.
Yeah, it's a fascinating case. And I think understanding the outcome of Kalipi isn't just important for understanding Kalipi itself. It really lays the groundwork for understanding a lot of the legal landscape mm-hmm. around Native Hawaiian rights that has developed since.
Yeah, absolutely.
So our goal today is to kind of really dig in and understand, you know, what were the key parts of this legal puzzle? How did the Hawaii Supreme Court arrive at its decision? And why is this decision so important, not just for Hawaiian law, but also just, you know, more broadly thinking about, you know, indigenous rights and how those interact with established legal systems.
So let's start to kind of unpack this. And to really get into Kalipi, we have to kind of lay out some of these foundational ideas. And I think one of the most important is this concept of the ahupua. So can you just talk a little bit about what that is and why it's so central to understanding this case?
Sure, yeah. The ahupua was the traditional Hawaiian land division. And it's not just like, you know, drawing lines on a map arbitrarily. This was a really key part of how Hawaiians lived and interacted with the land. So, mm-hmm. you know, picture like a wedge shape, right? Extending from the mountains all the way down to the sea. And that was really intentional. You know, folks living within the ahupua would have access to fresh water from the uplands, to fertile land for farming in the lowlands. And then, of course, marine resources from the ocean.
It's a fascinating system, right? I mean, it's this kind of holistic approach to managing both the land and the resources that it provides. And I imagine, I mean, it was obviously very deeply woven into the culture, right? It wasn't just about sort of arbitrary boundaries. It was about the way that people lived and interacted with their environment. So then we kind of fast forward, right? And we introduce these Western legal concepts, this idea of fee simple ownership. So how did those two things kind of starts to interact with each other?
Well, you know, that's really where Hawaii's legal landscape kind of develops its unique character. Because you have, unlike some other places where indigenous rights were largely extinguished, Hawaiian law has in various ways and to different extents, you know, acknowledged and tried to preserve some of these Native Hawaiian customary rights, even after the establishment of fee simple ownership.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you really have this inherent tension, right? I mean, you have this model of exclusive private ownership existing alongside, you know, this recognition that certain traditional practices hold a lot of cultural value and should be, you know, should be allowed to continue where possible.
Absolutely. And that tension is really what the Kalipi case
yeah.
is all about.
So let's get into Kalipi. Can you just kind of lay out the story of this case for us? You know, who was William Kalipi and what led to him, you know, filing this lawsuit?
Sure. So William Kalipi wanted to exercise what he believed were his traditional Hawaiian gathering rights. He wanted to go onto land, undeveloped land, within the ahupua of Ohia and Manawai on the island of Molokai.
Okay.
And he was hoping to gather materials that were traditionally used for cultural purposes. So things like, you know, tea leaf, bamboo, kukui nuts. There's, you know, various kinds of medicinal herbs and ferns that have been traditionally used in Hawaii. Now, here's a really important detail. While Kalipi had ancestral ties to Ohio and Manawai, and actually even owned some property there, at the time that he tried to gather these materials, he was actually living in a different ahupu, a place called Kiaweni.
Okay, interesting. So he had some connection to the land, but he wasn't living there full time when he attempted to exercise these rights. And so what was the response of the landowners?
Well, the landowners, which included Hawaiian Trust Company, denied him access, right? So they were essentially saying, you know, we own this property in fee simple, and you know, we have the right to exclude, we have the right to say who can and can't be on our property, and so, you know, you're not welcome here. And that's what prompted Kalipi to file a lawsuit claiming that he did have a right to gather these traditional materials. Now, the case initially went to trial, mm-hmm. And the jury actually ruled in favor of the landowners. Mm. So they sided with the landowners, but Kalipi, you know, took this up on appeal and it went to the Hawaii Supreme Court.
Right. And that's where it really gets interesting, right? Because now you have the Hawaii Supreme Court kind of stepping into this situation, and they have a really, really fundamental question, that they need to resolve. So what is the sort of central legal question or issue that the court was trying to answer in this case?
Well, the real central question in the case was whether, Hawaii Revised Statute Section 7.1, which specifically, you know, outlines certain traditional gathering rights, whether that applied to individuals who did not live in the particular ahupua where they were intending to gather.
Okay.
So in other words, does residency matter? You know, do you have to actually live in that particular land division in order to exercise those statutory rights? And related to that, a related question also kind of came up, which was, well, what about Hawaii Revised Statutes Section 1.1, which is a much broader statute? And it essentially says that, you know, Hawaiian common law, Hawaiian usage, when it's not contrary to written law, shall be the law of the state. Mm. And so, you know, could that broader statute potentially grant Kalipi the right to gather these materials, even if he wasn't a resident of Ohio or Manawai?
So that's really the core of what the court had to grapple with, right? I mean, these are the real central issues. So what did the court ultimately decide?
Yeah, so the court ultimately sided with the landowners.
Okay.
They held that traditional gathering rights under both HRS 7-1 and HRS 1-1 are limited to lawful residents of the ahupua where the gathering is sought. And because Kalipi was not residing in Ohio or Manawai at the time he tried to gather these materials, he was not entitled to exercise those rights there.
So let's dig into the court's reasoning a little bit here.
Yeah.
So starting with HRS 7-1, what was the logic behind the court's decision that residency was required? You know, what led them to that conclusion?
Well, the court really placed a lot of weight on the specific wording of the statute, which it refers to the people on each of their lands. And they interpret this phrase to mean, you know, the individuals who actually live on and have a connection to that particular land division, you know, essentially the residents. And their reasoning was that, you know, if you were to extend these gathering rights to just anyone, regardless of where they lived, you know, that would really disrupt the balance that the legislature was trying to strike between, you know, preserving traditional practices, but also respecting the principles of modern property ownership. And the idea was that these rights were, you know, traditionally exercised by and for the benefit of the community that was actually living within and managing the resources of that specific ahupua.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, you can sort of see that line of reasoning, right? Where you're trying to maintain that connection, right, mm-hmm. between the community and the land and the exercise of these rights. So then, how did the court address Kalipi's argument under HRS 1-1? You know, this kind of broader umbrella of recognizing Hawaiian custom.
Yeah. So under HRS 1-1, you know, which acknowledges and preserves Hawaiian customs when they don't conflict with written law, the court acknowledged its role in upholding those traditions. However, you know, they also made it clear that in the context of these gathering rights on private land, residency still mattered. You know, it was still a very important consideration. And they kind of introduced this idea of a balancing test, right, for any uncodified customs that are being claimed under 1-1. And so essentially this test would involve weighing the historical continuity, the cultural significance of the practice against, you know, any potential harm or burden that it might place on the landowner.
So even under this broader statute, right, which kind of seems like it's creating this avenue for recognizing, you know, a broader range of Hawaiian customs, the idea of residency is still a really important piece of the puzzle, right, in the court's analysis. Did the court specifically address, you know, Kalapi's argument that owning property within the Ahupua should be enough?
Yeah.
That even if he didn't live there, you know, that the fact that he owned property there should be sufficient to give him these gathering rights.
Yeah, they did address that. And they specifically rejected that argument.
Yeah.
Yeah, they said very clearly, we thus reject plaintiff's contention that the mere ownership of property within an Ahupua should suffice.
Okay.
You know, they emphasized that historically and traditionally, it was really the act of living within the Ahupua that gave rise to these kinds of access and usage rights. And not simply owning some land within that boundary.
And they were pretty clear about that, right? I mean, they were very direct in their language when they were discussing the residency requirement.
Absolutely, yeah. The court said very directly, traditional gathering rights do not accrue to persons, such as the plaintiff, who do not live within the Ahupua in which such rights are sought to be asserted.
Mm-hmm.
And that sentence, you know, really kind of encapsulates their holding on this really key issue.
So to kind of really nail this down, right, I mean, the court drew this really important distinction between just owning property in Ahupua and actually residing there, right,
yeah.
Living there. And they said that it's that residency, you know, not just the ownership, that is the key to exercising these specific gathering rights under HRS 701.
That's exactly right. And this case also highlights how, you know, you have this interplay between the very specific, you know, enumerated rights that are listed in 7.1, and then this kind of more general preservation of customs under 1.1. And even when considering the broader statute, you know, the court was really emphasizing this idea of balancing.
Right.
Balancing the continuation of tradition with the rights of property owners.
Mm-hmm.
And residency really factored into that balance.
Yeah, and it really does kind of highlight that balancing act that the judiciary often has to kind of walk.
Wow.
Right. I mean, it's this tension between wanting to respect and preserve cultural heritage, but also not wanting to completely undermine the existing system that
yeah.
we have in place. Right. Which is largely based on this idea of private property ownership and the rights that go along with that.
Yeah. And the court was really trying to navigate this incredibly complex legal and cultural landscape. And I think that's what makes the Kalapi decision, you know, so significant, because it really did establish this residency requirement as kind of a foundational principle for understanding these traditional gathering rights in Hawaii.
Yeah. And it's a great example, I think, of how, you know, sometimes these really important issues come up in a case that doesn't necessarily seem all that, you know, huge on its face.
Right.
You know, it's a dispute over gathering rights, but it really does kind of get at this much, much larger issue, which is, you know, how do we balance, you know, these different interests, right? These different legal frameworks, these different ways of relating to the land and to resources.
Absolutely. And the impact of Kalapi wasn't limited to just that specific case.
Right.
You know, subsequent cases, most notably Pele Defense Fund v. Patty, which was decided in 1992, directly referenced and built upon Kalapi. And so Pele Defense Fund was a case that explored whether, you know, native rights could potentially extend beyond you know, specific land boundaries in particular circumstances.
Correct.
But it still acknowledged, you know, the fundamental importance of the framework that Kalapi laid out about this connection between those rights and residency within, you know, a traditional land division. But if we were to kind of boil it all down, right, I mean, what is the sort of core rule or principle that emerged from the Kalapi decision? Yeah, I mean, I think the core rule that emerges from Kalapi is that generally speaking, in order to exercise gathering rights under HR 7.1, you have to be a resident of the Ahupua where you're hoping to gather. And those rights pertain to specific things, right?
Yeah.
To those specific items that are listed in the statute. And they're applicable on undeveloped land. And then, you know, when it comes to the broader customary rights under HRS 1.1, you know, residency still matters. It's still a significant factor, and you still have to go through that process of balancing,
right?
Balancing, you know, the continuation of the practice against the potential harms to landowners.
Yeah, so for you law students out there who are listening, you know, I think Kalapi is a great example of a case that really emphasizes, you know, the importance of statutory interpretation, right? The court really, you know, they dug deep into the language of HRS 7-1. But it also shows that the context matters so much, right? I mean, you can't just look at the words on the page. You have to really understand the history, the cultural significance of the AHUPA system, and how the courts are trying to reconcile that with, you know, these existing legal structures that we have, like private property.
Yeah, I mean, I think Kalapi has very practical implications for anyone who, you know, might practice law in Hawaii or you know, deals with issues around indigenous rights and property law more broadly. You know, you can't just look at the words on the page. You really have to think about the historical context, the cultural context, the societal context that those laws, you know, are operating within. And as Kalapi shows, you know, residency can be a really critical factor in figuring out, you know, the scope of these kinds of rights.
So I guess, you know, a final thought for everyone to kind of chew on is given all of the changes, right, that have happened in Hawaii since Kalapi was decided back in 1982. I mean, we've seen, you know, huge changes in terms of land use, in terms of demographics. You know, how do you think the courts are going to continue to kind of grapple with this?
Right, to try to negotiate and interpret this balance between traditional gathering rights and private property rights. And as we move forward, I mean, this is clearly an area of the law that is not settled, right? It's going to continue to evolve. And Kalapi really provides, I think, a foundational chapter in what's going to be, you know, a much, much longer story.
I think that's a really great question, and I think it's one that lawyers and judges are going to be wrestling with for many years to come.
Well, on that note, we're going to wrap up our deep dive on Kalapi for today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll see you next time.